The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for Helio. And just to say, Trevor is going to be kind of covering the sort of class struggle from below elements of this. So stay tuned for that portion of the presentation. So I wanted to, I kind of want to start off with just basically what's in the title of the talk, which is the heart of the issue, which is about what the new scramble for Africa is and how we can best understand this as people who are opposed to corporate globalization and to capitalism and to the exploitation that's taking place on that continent. So, essentially, the new scramble for Africa, not unlike the original colonial scramble for Africa, has been a rush by multinationals for all kinds of natural resources on the continent: oil, gold, platinum, metals, but also land. And this really kind of took off in sub-Saharan Africa around the turn of this century, or this turn of this millennium. And it's now an unprecedented boom in investment, in economic involvement on the continent, and so on. And this is really, I would argue, a new round of corporate plunder that has only enriched the tiny few, the investors, the multinationals, as well, and international capital, both Western and Chinese alike, and I would argue the ruling classes on the continent. So around the turn of the millennium, and this is when I started maybe not the turn of the millennium, but a few years after that, I started to pay attention to this topic, where there seemed to be this kind of explosion of this narrative about Africa rising in the business presses. I don't know if people kind of saw that. You would see like the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times would be, you know, kind of really excited about how there are these new economic opportunities for growth. Africa's this sort of untouched, opportunity in terms of profit making and so on. And at that time, there was, commodity prices were really soaring around the world. Oil, about a decade ago, was over $100 a barrel. But also, there was a huge interest in things like, agribusiness, but land, mining, all these kinds of things. And during that time, fuel and mineral exports from Africa began to soar into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And something important happened around that time, which is that historically, investment to Africa had always been dwarfed by the level of aid that went into Africa. And at that time, about 10 years ago, that actually began to flip, and the value of kind of natural resources on the African continent exceeded the aid that was coming into that. But what I want to talk about and emphasize, and what I go into in my book, is that process actually only enriched the people at the top of society and the multinationals, and actually further increased the poverty and class polarization on the African continent themselves. So this isn't a talk about necessarily the colonial history and the sort of plunder that happened in the first chapter of the previous chapters, but I want to give a quote from the Guyanese revolutionary Walter Rodney, who wrote this brilliant book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. If people haven't read it, it's probably one of the first stops to really understanding the sort of historic process of the plunder of Africa and its underdevelopment. And he made an important, had a really critical insight, which is to say that the underdevelopment, and this is his term, of Africa was actually completely implicated and tied up in the boom and the Industrial Revolution in Europe, and so and that the West would not have been able to take off without the slave trade, without the colonial plunder, and so on. And so these two processes are completely inextricable. And he wrote, "The operation of the imperialist system bears major responsibility for African economic retardation," again his word, "by draining African wealth and by making it impossible to develop more rapidly the resources of the continent." And so what I try to, what I would argue is that this history continues to reverberate down through this day. In terms of what this boom has, where this boom comes from, there's chairs over here. What it's about today, I mean, there's two main things that I just want to put out today. One is about the neoliberal prying open of African economies of the prior era, meaning the era of neoliberal structural adjustment, the World Bank and the IMF, and so on. And secondly, about the rise of China as a huge buyer of African commodities. So, I mean, firstly, the decades of privatization, structural adjustment and deregulation that were kind of unfurled around the globe in the neoliberal era have created is the kind of source of these investor-friendly conditions, environments in Africa. So, I mean, really, since the turn of the millennium, this boom in the African economy and industrial development has for China has spurred this drive for new markets, but really for new sources of energy and raw materials in Africa. So Africa is now China's largest trading partner, and literally China's footprint can be found across large swaths of the continent, including with the major oil producers, and countries with large developments, deposits of valuable minerals. So what is this kind of, so these are the two sort of main dynamics on the one hand about the sort of neo, and I'll get into this a little bit more, but about the decades of neoliberalism and now this kind of rise of China. But what does this look like concretely? So first of all, oil, as I said, oil prices have jumped up. Oil prices in the first decade of this millennium grew by 400%. So that's a soaring figure. And so really that gave a huge impetus to the growth in African economies. And so you had GDP rates, gross domestic product rates that reached into unprecedented levels that hadn't been seen before in the sub-Saharan continent, ranging from 5 and 10%. Oil imports from sub-Saharan Africa to the U.S. actually jumped in a pretty massive way, and around this time, oil from Africa surpassed oil that came from the Middle East. And today, the estimate is that roughly Africa possesses about 10% of the world's global oil reserves. And just to say that this kind of reliance, economic reliance on extraction and natural resources is very similar to it's got a different historical character, but it's not unlike the kind of the plunder and the reliance of natural resources from the previous era of the late 19th century. So just to kind of, I think that it's important to look at some of the way the expression of some of these like really sharp contradictions. And so I'm just going to put out a couple of things. I mean, for example, Guinea, the country of Guinea in West Africa, was kind of what I would call ground zero for the Ebola outbreak in 2014, a disease that was entirely preventable if it had been approached in a sort of with an eye towards investing in public health and so on. This country has the largest supply of bauxite, aluminum ore, right there. So the contradictions between the sort of potential wealth and the social level of social crisis. The same thing in a country like Zambia, one of the poorest countries in the world, has massive copper reserves that the Chinese economy is heavily reliant on. The Niger River Delta, The cover of my book is a picture of an oil spill in the Niger River Delta, and it's a Shell oil worker cleaning it up. It's literally, I would say, the most polluted spot on the face of the earth in terms of oil spills, in terms of gas flaring, and people who live without running water, electricity, and so on, alongside of the most valuable and strategically important commodity on the face of the globe. So I wanted to kind of highlight some of these really stark contradictions. So, so as I said before, that the part of this drive though is being driven by the boom in the Chinese economy, and China. It's just to sort of put a couple numbers behind what that looks like. I mean, China uses currently about 1/3 of the world's steel, 40% of its cement, and 40% of the entire world's supply of copper. I just mentioned Zambia, and is expected to be the world's largest oil importer by 2020. So China is now Africa's largest trading partner. So the economies on that continent and China are heavily implicated, in each other. But it's not just the process by which this China's economic involvement in on the continent has unfolded in a little bit of a different way, and they've secured drilling and mineral rights across the continent, but also have been very directed about kind of cementing, no pun intended, political allegiances with African regimes through development projects. And people may have heard about this, but there's been a huge explosion in the building of bridges and dams and roads, and also hospitals and stadiums and so on. And now currently loans in Africa from China have exceeded the World Bank. So China's playing a significant role along these lines. And its reach, literally, I mean, Chinese companies and both public and private, the spread across the continent is massive, not only in extraction, but also finance, telecommunications, and so on. 2/3 of the whole continent's infrastructure has been funded by China. But I think that this is, but there's a couple points I want to make about this. First of all, the development needs in Africa are, despite this huge surge, are very far from being met. I mean, I don't actually have the numbers in front of me, but the number of people that don't have access to electricity, to running water, to the internet, and so on, remain extremely stark. Let alone access to things like primary education, higher education, hospitals, and so on. The infrastructure gap in Africa is just astounding. But also, to understand that this sort of, kind of infrastructure for oil deals and what this looks like, China is not a kinder, gentler imperial force. It has a particular strategic approach to the process of accumulation and investment and political allegiances on this continent. And so, when they build roads and schools and so on, overall, it's to facilitate that process of resource extraction. And in the same way that so-called Western investment and corporate involvement has continued to reproduce and expand class inequality and exploitation, Chinese imperialism, I would argue, has likewise, accelerated that same process. So just to be sort of a little more specific about it, despite this kind of investor-friendly environment that the business presses are so excited about it, industrialization has been shown statistically to either have stagnated in sub-Saharan Africa or to have reversed. And I have some more statistics on this in my book. But essentially, that the sort of promise of Africa rising and the promise of pulling natural resources out of the ground would mean have failed in a colossal way to generate wider economic development and to begin to close that gap. And there's particular reasons for that people we can talk about, which is that, for one, pulling resources out of the ground is a very capital intensive process. It doesn't often create secondary industries, but also because of the legacy of colonialism and because of the way these economies were set up to be very heavily reliant on raw materials. And a lot of the kind of wider economic development that happens, like through refining and that type of thing, happens elsewhere. It happens in the West. Now, that's a very boiled down version, but there's historical, again, it's because of the legacies of colonialism and neoliberalism that these economies are so narrow and so lopsided. The World Bank did a report a few years ago that said that now in the wake of the kind of the peak of the boom, there are 100 million more Africans living in poverty than they were two decades earlier. So I think if that is not an incredibly stark indictment of this sort of, you know, Africa rising and open for business kind of narrative, then I really don't know what is. So why didn't this boom kind of level off some of the 5 minutes left? Oh my God. Okay. All right. Let me pick up the pace a little bit. Okay. I have to read this. So. President Obama, former President Barack Obama, was in Ghana in 2009, and he, I think, exemplified this sort of narrative that I think is now kind of dominant among the ruling classes, which is that the debt of colonialism has been paid, and any problems, any economic problems and so on, these are crises of your own making, and they are crises of your own responsibility. And this is what Obama said. Yes, a colonial map that made little sense bred conflict, and the West has often approached Africa as a patron rather than a partner, but the West is not responsible for the destruction of the Zimbabwean economy. They were in a particular crisis at the time over the last decade, or wars in which children are enlisted as combatants. This is not democracy, that is tyranny, and now is the time for it to end. Well, thank you very much, President Obama. So I think that what I don't really have time to go into here, but I think is really kind of the critical piece, is that version of history turns history on its head, and it completely negates the actual reality that what happened in the process of in the early independence period, there was a global economic crisis that really drove commodity prices to the ground and set up a lot of these new nations. These newly independent nations were thrown back into crisis in the process by when they were in the early stages of trying to build new economies, trying to diversify their economies and so on, and they were forced into essentially the arms of the World Bank and the IMF. When I say arms with barbed wire, and imposed all kinds of conditionalities by which that they gave bailouts. So those conditionalities were extremely harsh. They were austerity. They required privatization, budget cuts, disbanding of unions, and so on across Africa. So that's really when I referred to the neoliberal legacy. That is what I mean. And this process is not unique to Africa. It happened all over the global South, and actually in other places too, later in Eastern Europe and so on. But I say this because there's a dominant kind of idea or notion, and even among sort of well-meaning people, that Africa has been neglected. And in some sense you can say that's true, but I think that it's also important for us to understand that Africa was not neglected as well. It was disinvested and it was plundered, and that was a conscious part of a global ruling class strategy to restore the profits and the economic crisis of the 70s and 80s at the expense of people in the global South. So I guess I'm just going to sort of wrap up. How much time do I have? 1 minute left?
2 minutes.
2 minutes left. Okay. I want to say something a little bit more about China and this very dangerous militarization that's happening in Africa. And Trevor and I first met, we were at a conference a couple months ago in Tanzania, and there were big debates about and big questions about what's the role of China in Africa. Is it an imperial power? Is it a sub-imperial power? Is it something else? Could it be a force for economic development? And these are good questions and important questions I think the left are grappling with in Africa, because you know, it's not a clear-cut thing, just as there's been debates at, I think, a dentist's meeting the other day, some of these questions came up on China as well. I think that what's become quite clear is that for one, China's expansion and China's ability to kind of take off in Africa has really been partly because of neoliberalism, the neoliberal policies that the West has pushed through, and they've been able to take advantage of that and are now posing a serious challenge, and I would say an imperial challenge in terms of relative to US's involvement and kind of sort of hold on that continent. And what this has done is, I think, created an acceleration, not just of a kind of in a militarized sense, but also overall strategically, economically on that continent. So on the military side, about 10 years ago, George W. Bush, remember him? He introduced something called AFRICOM, which is the Africa Military Command, in which, so now the legacy of that is just a swath of military bases, drone airfields, all kinds of covert sort of military operations all over the continent. But China's strategic interest in Africa has, you know, is that's been ratcheting up as well. And so what that has meant is that China's military involvement in Africa has also increased apace in along with its economic involvement. So there's its first major military base outside of the sort of the Asian sphere is located on the African nation of Djibouti. It's the most highly represented nation in the UN peacekeeping troops on Africa, and it's one of the top arms kind of dealers. So all this to say is that I do think that there's very clear evidence of China as a rising imperial power beginning to come into play and into conflict over on this continent, just as is playing out in other places. And I think the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a $1 trillion sort of global initiative on the part of China, is highlighting the stakes. So I'm going to end just on this last point, which is that I think this involvement and China's kind of search for resources as well as the West has created contradictions and instability in the system and what Marxists would call a crisis of overcapacity. And I think that this, a few years ago, the oil prices crashed, other global commodity prices crashed, and this was devastating to African economies in places like Nigeria. There were massive government budget cuts, layoffs, and things like that. But in a broader sense, I think that this makes a case for an alternative to this kind of to a capitalist system that creates these very unstable economies where the kind of the volatility of commodity prices can send continents into disarray and into economic crisis and create huge levels of social misery and so on, paired with the kind of ratcheting up and militarization that we're now seeing on the continent. And so I think that these contradictions are making this landscape an increasingly volatile and unstable terrain, and that really the sane solution is a socialist alternative and a working class alternative, which Trevor is going to pick up the reins and talk more about. Thanks so much.
Amanda!
Amanda!
I was looking for you. Someone must know this. Okay, thank you, comrades. It's a real great pleasure and honor to be here addressing this conference. Sorry.
Mic slightly up.
Oh, okay.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. So, yeah, as Comrade Lee was saying, we've got a very serious problem in Africa. The condition of the working class is not improving much, especially given under the current conditions of capitalist global crisis. And as she has said, there have been talk of Africa rising, but nothing much has come of that. Also, only last week, there was a signing of what is going to be an Africa-wide free trade zone. But you know, the ink has hardly got dry on that, and the conditions and terms of that, you know, are still not, have not been scrutinized. It's a bit open-ended. In any case, even if they do sign the free trade agreement, you know, that does mean that the business interests which are linked with the metropoles, with the multinational corporations, are going to suddenly disappear. So even that is going to be a struggle. But the fact that they are signing a Pan-African trade agreement resuscitates in our minds that dream, that vision, which was put by Kwame Nkrumah already in 1955, 52. Nkrumah was a Pan-Africanist. He was the first president of a liberated Ghana. Ghana was called the Gold Coast before that, so you can see how it was viewed. This is where we get our gold. So Nkrumah had this vision of what he called a United States of Africa. He wanted one big government or state to cover the whole of Africa as a mechanism to protect Africans from exploitation from their various colonizers. As you know, the British colonized Africa, the French, the Belgians, the Germans, everyone had a peace. So Nkrumah felt that if we united, we could buff them off. Okay, so towards this end, Nkrumah organized and they formed the Organization of African Unity. So, but unfortunately, from day one, there was a debate inside the Organization of African Unity because some people, such as the first president of Côte d'Ivoire, you know, is a country next to Ghana. It was called the Ivory Coast. So the president of the Ivory Coast did not agree with the president of the Gold Coast next door because Hofuud Boigny saw his interests and the interests of his country tied to those of France, the former colonizer. So the first platform program of the OAU was compromised because, for example, Nkrumah wanted a tighter, a more accountable, a more binding vision, whereas Boigny and those behind him wanted a looser OAU. So I'm sure if you know you follow the OAU over the years, it tends to be all over the show because it's not coherent. Yeah. Okay, in 2002, Thabo Mbeki, who was the president of South Africa, who came after Mandela, he worked with the Nigerian president Obasanjo, Wade, and another African leader, and they came with a new vision. Mbeki called it the African Renaissance. And then Mbeki and them wanted a tighter OAU, and they gave it a new name, the African Union. Okay, they did try, for example, they have the famous peer review mechanism whereby they try and limit, you know, undemocratic methods of taking power in Africa. So if you have a coup or you kill the president and take over, the AU won't recognize you. But of course, you know, they haven't been able to deal with existing and current dictators. For example, they let Robert Mugabe go on for years and years, and other dictators. And then on the economic front, I think, you know, the African Union failed because they adopted a program called NIPED, which is the New Partnership for Africa's Development. Unfortunately, this program was on a neoliberal, pro-capitalist platform. So, you know, there was no hope of it actually challenging, let alone pushing back imperialist interests in Africa. And after all those years, this has been proved correct. I mean, you had the figures just given by Comrade Lee that the rich are still getting richer and the poor poorer in Africa. Of course, the idea of Africa rising is because some countries like Rwanda experienced economic growth consistently. But it's a question how that economic growth was affected in terms of democracy, in terms of, you know, where the money is going to. Basically, you know, Kagame, the president, is adopting a trickle-down model of development. So you get economic growth, but it's jobless growth, and the poor get poorer. So one could argue that there is a development impasse or dead end or stalemate in Africa. And the question is, what is the way forward? But if we're going to find the way forward, we have to look back and analyze where is this impasse, this stalemate, this logjam coming from. So I'll just go quickly over what I will call theories of development, which have inspired and guided African leaders and movements. So we all know W.W. Rousseau, modernization theory, which said that all countries must follow stages of development, and at the end, the norm, the goal is America. You must be like the US, okay? Yeah, so of course that didn't wash because it never happened. And then we've got someone called André Gunda Frank, who came with, you know, a theory called the development of underdevelopment, where he tried to show that, in fact, he argued that the closer former colonies worked with their former colonizers, you know, the poorer they became, because the, you know, the wealth, the surplus keeps on being extracted. Okay? But he framed it in this way: the Western countries are exploiting third world countries. So, you know, as Marxist class dynamics get lost there, you know, because it's hard to imagine a whole country exploiting another country. And also you find that within the exploited countries, there are some class forces who benefit from that exploitation, or who at least facilitate that exploitation, such as African government leaders themselves. Okay, yeah. So that theory was replaced by dependency theory, which is similar, and which had that problem too, because it couldn't explain why, for example, the Asian tigers took off and industrialized, whereas many countries in Africa did not. So in a way, you know, the theory doesn't explain well the different outcomes. So, okay, I won't go into the last one, which is the modes of production theory, except to say that it tends to focus on what is called forces of production. So in a way, what we need as Marxists is a self-critique where we don't apply these theories, you know, without thinking carefully. For example, you'll find that especially, let's say, Stalinist development strategies, state capitalist development strategies tend to focus or to emphasize a kind of evolutionism, like a stagist, you know, feudalism, capitalism, socialism is almost inevitable. And then also a kind of functionalism where the needs of the system will deliver. A bit of dogmatism, you know, will win whatever, you know. And then also emphasizing structure over agency. So I'm going to talk about the importance of agency in the struggle for Africa's liberation from economic development. That was just showing you the background in terms of theory of how these problems are approached. Now, in the attempt to solve Africa's problems, an important conference was what is called the Bandung Conference, which happened in 1955. So you might know the great political economist Samir Amin. So Samir Amin writes about the Third World, inspired by his attending that conference. And this was a conference of Asian and African countries who had just got their independence and wanted a new way forward for their economies, improvement for their economies. So this is when we can say what was born was third world nationalism, the idea that we, as you know, the former colonies, can make it for our countries. And then the theories and the programs of development they adopted, for example, was import substitution industrialization, trying to stop the West from flooding their economies with goods and services, by trying to actually use endogenous, their own supplies, to, you know, move forward. Okay, also today we could call it a developmental state, relying on the state to push and develop the economy in such a way that it benefits the country, not the imperialists. But the problem with the approach was that, firstly, it was state-centered. I mean, you know, so the state, rather than the working class, was at the forefront. And then also, because of that, it was top-down. So, you know, the leaders told the masses, the peasants, what to do. And, of course, it was capitalist. So it wasn't socialist. It was trying to find a place within the capitalist global order, a better place maybe for African economies and states. Now, this approach, third world nationalism, import substitution industrialization, hit a dead end when, especially in Africa, there was, because people were using their raw materials to fund this program. So cocoa, rubber, you know, gold, the gold, ivory. But when there was a downward, in the price of commodities, these countries found themselves in trouble. So they found themselves, you know, they can't balance the books. So as Lee said, they then had to go to the World Bank to borrow. And then they got caught up in structural adjustment programs where the West, the capitalist advanced countries, were now telling them again how to develop and run their own countries. So this was the problem. But having called it third world nationalism, what we see therefore is a basic contradiction between the class and the nation. Yeah. Because the best of these leaders, okay, Nkrumah, Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, Nyerere had a vision and he lived it, he tried. He wanted an African version of socialism. He wanted ujamaa, okay? Yeah. But his approach was almost the same as, okay, you know, as the same as the Russian Narodniki, you know, the populists, yeah. Yeah, because he argued that in Africa, there were no classes. So he came with this program of villagization. Everyone must go to a village because Africans have always been doing things communally. And then he got really disappointed because those same villagers exhibited, you know, self-interest, and there was a lot of joking. And well, the leadership, the petty bourgeoisie of Tanzania was busy with self-enrichment. Yeah, so this was a problem. Also, Nyerere himself, because of this villagization, it started as a voluntary program. But then as people started to resist, he started forcing them, go to the village, because it was top down. It was not responding to what the ordinary people, the peasants, wanted. So these problems raise another question, you know, whose vision inspired the new independent countries? Who was leading? And then this takes us back to who was leading the struggle for national liberation. So when we look at that, we find that the struggle for national liberation was led by the African petty bourgeoisie. You know, I'm not using it as an insult, although in South Africa it's used as an insult. But as a class, as a type of middle class, so you get guys like me who were educated by the missionaries, okay? Yeah. Many people were sent overseas to go and study, get their degrees. In fact, many revolutions in Africa were put together, planned overseas, in universities, in London, in France. You know, the elite, the students met there, discussed, and then said, let's go home and liberate our people, okay? Yeah. So, indeed, if I talk about South Africa, the African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, their theory was that when we get our independence, this is now, you can see, is the view of the African elite. When we get our independence, we must create a patriotic bourgeoisie, that is capitalist, who will have a heart and, you know, be considerate to our people. Okay, yeah, yeah. Okay, now, okay, maybe that's a bit naive, but Amilcar Cabral, who was a more, Amilcar Cabral was the first president of Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde. You know, a good revolutionary, Marxist revolutionary. He wrote books, he thought about these things. And, you know, for his troubles, he was assassinated. So Amilcar Cabral, he grappled with this problem, and then he came with a solution. Okay, these missionary-educated people, yes, they must lead the national struggle, but at some point, they must commit class suicide. What is class suicide? This is, you must stop thinking like a petty bourgeois and adopt a kind of working-class politics. You must do away with petty bourgeois sensibilities, bourgeois aspirations, and be one with the masses and be one with the people. But of course, we know now with hindsight that Cabral's theory wasn't going to work. Yeah, because as soon as these guys took power, they started enriching themselves. You know, all the bad habits of missionaries came back now suddenly. You know, yeah. So, in fact, it was Frantz Fanon, who was, you know, a revolutionary in Algeria, who seemed to have got it right. Because Fanon said, don't trust the national bourgeoisie. In fact, they are hucksters. They are good for nothing. You know, they'll just lead the revolution over the cliff. Okay, yeah. So, now, there's another problem also, which is more to do with politics rather than just the class position of those who led the African revolution. And this is what I call the two stages of revolution. So many African leaders, partly influenced by Stalinist ideas, social democratic ideas, but also driven by their own class interests and also the search for a shortcut, because the road of revolution is hard, So they came with this two-stage theory of revolution, whereby the first stage would get our national independence on a capitalist platform. And then once we're in power, we'll fight for a socialist transformation. But this didn't happen. It did not happen at all. For example, in South Africa, our president is Cyril Ramaphosa, who was a union leader. He was a great leader of the mine workers. But as soon as, you know, we got our independence, he became a leader of the ANC. He became a billionaire. Like, he became a mining magnate. It's the same with Dos Santos in Angola. He's a billionaire. So this shows that, you know, this two-stage theory, you know, will never get us to socialism, because the guys at the first stage start now organizing to become rich. And the worst part is that during the first stage, now the elite, the political elite, the new bourgeoisie start containing working class struggle and forcing workers, no, don't strike. It's against the national interest. Yeah. This was said already in South Africa by Joe Slovo, who was the leader of the Communist Party in exile, even before we got our independence in 1994. So between 1990, when Mandela was released from jail, and 94, Joe Slovo was already telling workers, don't strike, it will damage our economy. Okay. So, but now my last point, because I think I must...
Three minutes,
yeah. Is that if then the way forward is not the African petty bourgeoisie, the aspirant bourgeoisie, who will drive and liberate and take forward the emancipation of the African people, the African working class, and where it still exists, the African peasantry? Now, in South Africa, we saw in 2012, because this containment of the working class was made into an art in South Africa. So what happened is that the ANC of Mandela, they formed what is called the Tripartite Alliance. The ANC, the Communist Party, and COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions. So they made this formal alliance, whose real job was to contain workers and stop them from striking against capital. So this went on for 20 years, 24 years, and then the workers said, enough is enough. In the mines, the cheap labor system, you know, the migrant labor system of apartheid continues to this day. So workers wanted more money. They went to their union, the National Union of Mine Workers, the one which was formed by Ramaphosa, and the union was too close to the bosses. So the workers broke out, they formed their own workers' committee, and then they went out on strike. And then the response of the ANC government was to shoot and kill the workers. This was the Marikana massacre in 16 August 2012. 34 striking miners were shot dead by the ANC police. Yeah. So, okay, you know, it exposed the class character of the ANC state, or as run by the state. But at the same time, it also showed the power, the determination of the working class, you know, to improve their lives. Because after 34 mine workers were shot dead, the workers continued their strike for another 3 weeks, and they won a substantial increase. So by doing that in Marikana, they gave birth to what I call the spirit of Marikana. What is the spirit of Marikana? It is the spirit of defiance, the spirit of forward ever, backward never. It is the spirit of do or die, the spirit of no surrender, no compromise. Because that is what those workers who went and camped on that mountain exhibited. Yeah. So after Marikana, we saw a realignment. So Marikana forced a realignment of the alliance. The biggest trade union in South Africa, NUMSA, I've got their t-shirt, the Metal Workers Union, pulled out of the alliance and is now busy forming a workers' party. Yeah. So, also students at universities were inspired, and there was the Roads Must Fall movement, Fees Must Fall, Outsourcing Must Fall. So my last point is that let us not look up when we want a way forward for Africa. Let's look down. Let us look across to our fellow working class brothers and sisters. Because the working class is the only class which, if it took over, would not need to exploit anyone, because it is itself exploited. So the way forward for Africa is development and struggle led by the working class. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.